So this morning we look at Hezekiah, whose story embraces several chapters again in 2 Chronicles. We'll read a few verses from 2 Chronicles 32, hoping that for most of you, at any rate, the story is familiar or you've had the chance to read it through. 2 Chronicles 32. The first two verses, and then picking again at verse 6. After all that Hezekiah had so faithfully done, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. He laid siege to the fortified cities, thinking to conquer them for himself. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and that he intended to make war on Jerusalem, verse 6, he appointed military officers over the people and assembled them before him in the square at the city gate and encouraged them with these words, "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged because of the king of Assyria and the vast army with him, for there is a greater power with us than with him. With him is only the arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles." How do you cope with a crisis? At some time or other, we all have to face them, don't we? Usually, just fairly private affairs localized within our own family circle, domestic crises, as we call them. But every now and again, an emergency erupts on the stage of world history, which has much wider ramifications than that. Emergencies which propel whole nations into anxiety and distress, not just families. As we mentioned yesterday, as some of us here, I suspect, can remember that exactly 50 years ago, this land was on the brink of just one such international crisis. And in some respects, those dark and uncertain days of 1939 bear a startling similarity to the predicament in which the people of Judah found themselves at the end of the 8th century, at the end of the 8th century BC, when King Hezekiah came to the throne. For once again, then, a formidable engine of militaristic aggression was threatening her, Assyria. Under a succession of brilliant generals, Assyria had embarked on a program of conquest and occupation, every bit as grandiose in its conception as that of Nazi Germany in the last war. The aim was quite simply to dominate the whole of the Middle East. Just as in the 1930s, nations which surrendered meekly and without resistance to the Assyrian juggernaut were allowed to retain some pretense of independence. Their economies were drained to the point of bankruptcy by crippling demands for protection money, it's true. Their kings were reduced to the state of little more than puppets of the Assyrian government, but they survived. Any state, however, which refused to accept such humiliation and tried to rebel against Assyria's territorial demands was crushed with devastating cruelty. Assyria was not content merely to defeat the armies of such rebel states on the field of battle, though she did that with ruthless efficiency. Assyria went on in such cases to lay siege to the major cities. She knew that once food ran out, it was only a matter of time before the civilian population were driven by hunger to surrender. And that's when Assyria applied the coup de grace, a novel strategy of subjugation which she had invented. In order to make quite sure that such patriotic resistance to her authority didn't reawaken at some later time, Assyria's generals ordered mass deportations of the conquered populations. People were forced, literally by tens of thousands, to move to remote and unfamiliar corners of the Middle East, while their own homelands were repopulated with similarly displaced foreigners from elsewhere. In this way, the Assyrians sought to break the back of nationalistic aspiration and sentiment. Hers, you see, was a regime which, just like Nazi Germany, wasn't content simply to be top dog in the Middle East. She wanted to eat all the other dogs in the district too. She wanted to consume an entire subcontinent in a single political identity, the Assyrian Empire. Now, not since her days in Egypt had the Jews encountered this kind of imperialistic ambition. that skirmish, you could almost call it, which Jehoshaphat had to deal with, which Basil was reminding us of last night, was a minor affair in comparison with this. And by the time Hezekiah got to the throne, Assyria's program of territorial expansion was already at its height. And the people of God were already feeling the pinch. You remember we mentioned the division into the north and the south, Israel and Judah. When Hezekiah came to the throne, the northern 10 tribes were already in dire straits. Samaria was besieged. It would only be a matter of a few months or a year or two at the most before her population, according to the usual Assyrian way, would be taken from the northern 10 tribes to distant parts of the Assyrian Empire and dispersed, never to be seen again. As for Judah, the smaller kingdom in the south, Hezekiah's father Ahaz had chosen the path of appeasement rather than resistance. He had become a voluntary vassal of the emperor of Assyria. And as a result of that policy of appeasement, Judah was in no immediate danger of Assyrian reprisal when Hezekiah came to the throne. Peace had been purchased, but at an immense cost. One is tempted to compare the way in which Hezekiah's father Ahaz came back from the emperor of Assyria with the way in which Neville Chamberlain came back from Munich waving that piece of white paper. Well, did Woodrow Wilson say in the First World War, there is a price which is too great to pay for peace. Ahaz had paid that price. He had purchased peace for Judah, but at the cost of the self-respect of the nation. Not only had her independence been forfeited, not only had her economy been mortgaged to the Assyrian war machine. More important than either of these things, Judah's spiritual morale had suffered a crippling blow. You put yourself in her place and you'll quickly sense it. Here she was, the so-called people of God. But she had now been reduced to a tiny, powerless remnant, dwarfed and humiliated by the titanic might of a vast pagan empire. Now, how on earth could she go on believing in the religion of Moses in such circumstances? It felt ridiculous. If Jehovah was so strong, why on earth were his people in such a powerless condition? Idolatry for a number of years had been infiltrating Judah and presented a threat. With this acceptance of Assyrian domination, that paganizing trend became a tidal wave of apostasy. People just gave up on God. Ahaz himself, Hezekiah's father, had led the way in this, openly confessing his own contempt for the religion of his forefathers, by converting, of all things, to the religion of Damascus, of Syria. If you look back at chapter 28, verse 22, you'll see the chronicler comments on this. 28:22, in his time of trouble, King Ahaz became even more unfaithful to the Lord. He offered sacrifices to the gods of Damascus, who had defeated him. For he thought, since the gods of the kings of Aram have helped them, I will sacrifice to them, so they will help me. Pathetic and illogical, really, since Assyria would conquer Damascus too. But this was the measure of religious confusion of the day. More and more people were taking the view that it didn't really matter what god you worshipped, so long as it wasn't Jehovah, who clearly was no use to anybody. Indeed, so widespread was the atmosphere of spiritual disillusionment, the chronicler goes on to tell us in chapter 28, verse 24, that the great temple of Solomon had fallen into disuse. Its doors were locked. Its services had been cancelled. Now, this may have been done at least in part on Assyrian orders. The Book of Kings hints at as much. But even if that were so, there doesn't seem to have been much public disquiet about such a move. Instead, we're told, in no time at all, pagan altars were springing up on every street corner in Jerusalem and pagan shrines on every hillside outside. quite clearly a large percentage of the population of Judah had simply given up on the religion of the Bible. Assyrian victory had opened a credibility gap. And into the spiritual vacuum thus generated, all kinds of pagan superstition and Canaanite practice were finding ready clients. So when Hezekiah came to the throne, you see, it wasn't just a political crisis he faced. It was a crisis of faith for the nation. That's what I want you to get hold of this morning. The very survival of biblical religion was hanging in the balance when this man came to the throne. The military threat which Assyria posed was just a symbol, really, of a much more serious spiritual threat which Assyria posed to Judah's survival as the people of God, as the people of Jehovah. And it's against the background of that crisis which Hezekiah faced, which makes this story of Hezekiah so important, of such special interest to the chronicler. You see, a secular historian might well want to interpret Hezekiah's story as just a simple political rebellion. A fiercely nationalistic people revolt against the imperialist tyranny of their Assyrian master, and by a stroke of good luck, they manage to get away with it. You could see some parallels with the story of Afghanistan today, perhaps. And it is clear from the account of Hezekiah's reign in the Book of Kings that there is a measure of truth in that perspective. Hezekiah certainly was a reluctant vassal of Assyria and did do things which were deliberately provocative. But the point the chronicler wants us to note is that Hezekiah's fundamental motivation in this was not the simple political one of wanting to re-establish Judah's independence. No, he was concerned about the restoration of her religious faith. That was the great issue for this king. As far as Hezekiah was concerned, the real enemy that threatened Judah's survival was not the Assyrian army at all, but unbelief. And the reason the chronicler is keen to tell Hezekiah's story is because he wanted his own contemporaries to understand how under Hezekiah's leadership, Judah laid to rest that bogey of unbelief, that her spiritual identity survived in spite of this formidable threat which the Assyrian Empire posed. That at the end of this crisis, she emerged still a believing people. That's what he wants them to see. That was absolutely vital for his own people to understand in the days after the exile. And as we look at it this morning, I hope you will agree with me that the way Hezekiah tackled this crisis of faith is of great relevance to us too. Now, he did it in three stages, and I'd like you to identify those with me. The first way in which Hezekiah coped with this crisis of faith, which he faced when he came to the throne, was to reform the church. The second thing he did was to re-evangelize the nation. And the third thing which he did was to refuse to surrender to the enemy. Let's look at those three things and then see how they might apply to our situation today. First, he reformed the church. Look at chapter 29, verse 3. In the first month of the first year of his reign, he didn't waste any time, you see, he opened the doors of the temple of the Lord and repaired them. He brought in the priests and the Levites, assembled them in the square on the east side and said, "Listen to me, Levites. Consecrate yourselves now and consecrate the temple of the Lord, the God of your fathers. Remove all defilement from the sanctuary." Now it's quite clear that certain elements of the priesthood had colluded with Hezekiah's father Ahaz in the paganization of Judah. The Book of Kings tells us quite explicitly that it was Uriah the priest who had built that idolatrous altar to the gods of Damascus that we just read about in chapter 23. He did it on Ahaz's instructions, but it was Uriah the priest who built it. And verse 11, if you look down at chapter 29 again, verse 11 rather implies, doesn't it, that he wasn't alone in this neglect of his divine vocation. For Hezekiah says to these Levites, "My sons, do not be negligent now." The implication being they had been negligent before. The first thing Hezekiah had to do, if he was to restore biblical religion among his people, was to purge this apathy and apostasy from the professional clergy, from the religious leaders, from those to whom the people looked for spiritual example and direction. And that's what we see him doing in this chapter 29. He summons what you could say was the ancient equivalent of a Lambeth conference. And he tells them straight what, in point of fact, of course, they should have been telling him. See in verse 6. Our fathers were unfaithful. They did evil in the eyes of the Lord our God and forsook him. They turned their faces away from the Lord's dwelling place and turned their backs on him. A comment, you see, on what Ahaz had been doing. They shut the doors of the portico and put out the lamps. They didn't burn incense or present any burnt offerings at the sanctuary. Therefore, the anger of the Lord has fallen on Judah and Jerusalem, and he has made us an object of dread and horror and scorn, as you can see with your own eyes. This is why our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and daughters and our wives are in captivity. Now I intend to make a covenant with the Lord, the God of Israel, so that his fierce anger will turn away from us. My sons, don't be negligent now, for the Lord has chosen you to stand before him and serve him, to minister incense before him, and so on. Now, reading a little between the lines, I think it's likely that not all who heard this royal sermon took kindly to being thus lectured on their ecclesiastical duties. Verse 34 clearly suggests that the less privileged clerical orders, the Levites, responded with a good deal more enthusiasm to Hezekiah's exhortations than did some of the higher ranks of the priestly hierarchy. You see what I mean if you look down at verse 34. But that's often the way it is, of course, when it comes to reformation in the church. It's often the rank and file of ordinary church ministers who carry the thing forward. Often the last people to accept the need for change are the bishops. But even if some of his senior churchmen were dragging their heels, it does say much, doesn't it, for the esteem in which this young king was held by the majority of the Levites, that this sermon of his achieved such a rapid result. Look at verse 17. They began the consecration of the temple on the first day of the month, and by the eighth day of the month they reached the portico. For 8 more days they consecrated the temple of the Lord, finishing on the 16th day of the first month. There it is, a fortnight then. That's all it took. And they had reversed at least the physical consequences of Ahaz's apostasy. The temple was ready for use once more. Look at verse 36. So the service of the temple of the Lord was re-established. Hezekiah and all the people rejoiced at what God had brought about for his people because it was done so quickly. It's an interesting comment, isn't it? It happened so fast. All it took, you see, was a single courageous sermon challenging the church to be true to its calling, and like fire on the dry grass, the Reformation caught the imagination of those younger churchmen who for too long had kept their silence while compromise and heresy prevailed amongst their ecclesiastical superiors. We must never underestimate, you know, how rapidly the church scene can change, how rapidly the spiritual caliber of the church can be transformed, no matter how infiltrated by doctrinal error or spiritual deadness it is to start with. Once an inferno of such reformation starts to burn within it. History confirms this to us again and again. That's the first thing Hezekiah did then. He reformed the church. The second thing he did was to re-evangelize the nation. Look at chapter 30, verse 6. At the king's command, couriers went throughout Israel and Judah with letters from the king and from his officials, which read, "People of Israel, return to the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may return to you." Now, if you look carefully, you'll see this is altogether a remarkable initiative on Hezekiah's part, because it is directed, you see, at the whole of Israel, all 12 tribes, not just the principality of Judah, of which he was officially the king. Now, for 300 years or more, Judah and Israel had been two separate and often hostile kingdoms, Hezekiah could hardly fail to be aware that in his father's day, the king of Israel had actually invaded Judah and inflicted heavy losses on her troops. Well, now the boot was on the other foot. The northern province had been deported by the Assyrians. There was just a scattered remnant of people who'd escaped capture in the northern tribes now. It would have been very easy, very understandable, if Judah had taken a measure of satisfaction from that. Serve them right for being such bullies. But Hezekiah's tone, you see, contains no hint of such smugness. He addresses the northern and southern tribes together as brothers and calls them both to a shared act of national repentance. Notice the repeated use of that phrase, return to the Lord, in verse 6. People of Israel, return to the Lord. Verse 9, if you return to the Lord. That's significant because it's the very same verb which occurred in that famous promise to Solomon that we referred to yesterday. If my people who are called by my name humble themselves, seek my face, and turn, same verb, turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and forgive their sins and heal the land. Hezekiah then is urging the people here to claim that divine assurance, just as Jehoshaphat had done several generations earlier. If you return to the Lord, verse 9, then your brothers and your children will be shown compassion by their captors and will come back to this land. For the Lord your God is gracious and compassionate. He will not turn his face from you if you turn to him. And what occasion could be more appropriate for such a time of national reunification and repentance than a feast of Passover? Passover was for the Jews what Holy Communion is for a Christian. The sacramental sign which more than any other spoke of their unity and of God's salvation. Rooted, as it were, in their common memory of the Exodus deliverance. It reminded them how God had saved them from the tyranny of Egypt. Well, if he saved them once, why shouldn't he fulfill his promise to Solomon and save them again, this time from the hand of the Assyrian? So Hezekiah's evangelists take this message, this invitation, from one end of the country to the other, scouring the towns and villages of the north and south to make contact with sometimes long alienated Israelite brothers from those tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun. Now, chronicler is frank that the reception they got was not always favorable. Verse 10. The couriers went from town to town, but some of the people scorned and ridiculed them, we read. But then there were encouragements too. Some, in spite of old prejudices, were sufficiently moved by Hezekiah's appeal to swallow their pride, verse 11. Nevertheless, some men of Asher and Manasseh and Zebulun humbled themselves and went to Jerusalem. And so it was, you see, when the big day came, there was for the first time in many years a large number of people from both north and south gathered together to celebrate the Passover of their redeeming God. The atmosphere of religious enthusiasm must have exceeded Hezekiah's wildest dreams. It must have almost seemed like an FIEC assembly. One word keeps reappearing in the chronicler's description of the whole show. Joy. Like in verse 21. The Israelites who were present in Jerusalem celebrated the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days with great rejoicing, while the Levites and the priests sang to the Lord every day, accompanied by the Lord's instruments of praise. Well, we're going to have a bit of that later, aren't we? Indeed, so much joy was there in the city that at the end of the appointed 7 days of feasting, verse 23 tells us, they all had a vote and decided they'd go on for another 7 days. I don't know what Warners would have thought if we had passed such a motion at the business meeting yesterday. But that's what they did. And this newfound enthusiasm didn't dissolve away when the big meeting was over either. Chapter 31 tells us how these Israelites left that Passover feast charged with a new spiritual zeal. They purged the streets of Jerusalem of those pagan altars, and when they left the city, they went through the length and breadth of the countryside, purging paganism there too. And when Hezekiah, a little while later, announced to everybody that the temple needed funds to support the ministry, the response was immediate and overwhelming. Look at 31 verse 5. As soon as that order went out, the Israelites generously gave the first fruits of their grain, new wine, oil, and honey, and all that the fields produced. They brought a great amount, a tithe of everything. Now, what can you call this kind of injection of spiritual enthusiasm, this kind of mass return to the Lord, except a revival? For they do happen, as Basil was telling us so powerfully last night. He reformed the church then. He re-evangelized the nation. But thirdly, and this is what I particularly want you to draw to notice this morning, he refused to surrender to the enemy. And that brings us to the verses we read. After all that Hezekiah had so faithfully done, chapter 32, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah. Now, almost certainly, Assyria perceived this resurgence of nationalistic religion as a gesture of rebellion. Hezekiah probably didn't have to do anything politically provocative. As far as Assyria was concerned, this kind of religious reformation was provocation in its own right. Then it has to be said, too, that Hezekiah did little to defuse the situation. If you look at verse 2 of chapter 32, we're told that immediately on hearing that the Assyrian forces were on their way, he first re-engineers the city's water supply to make it less vulnerable to besieging forces. 2, rebuilds the city walls. 3, opens an arms factory. Now, these are not the actions of a loyal vassal who is anxious to conciliate the emperor and assure him that his religious activities have been misrepresented. Now, Hezekiah knew he had to fight the Assyrian. He knew he had to defeat him. And that's what, in his rather simplified account of this siege, the chronicler draws our attention to. Notice again those words with which he encourages his soldiers. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or discouraged because of the king of Assyria and the vast army with him, for there is a greater power with us than with him. With him is only the arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord, Jehovah, our God, to help us and fight our battles. Now I say again, Hezekiah knew he had to fight Assyria and he had to win. Not for the sake of political independence, but because only thus would the faith of his people be secure for future generations. It was doubt born of Assyrian domination which had led his father to abandon the religion of the Bible in the first place. Only by a great victory of faith over that doubt could he ensure that the same wouldn't happen again. But holding out in that way against the ravages of doubt must have been far from easy. Especially when the siege began and the propaganda started. Look at verse 9. When Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and all his forces were laying siege to Lachish, he sent his officers to Jerusalem with this message for Hezekiah, king of Judah, and for all the people of Judah who were there. This is what Sennacherib, king of Assyria, says. On what are you basing your confidence that you remain in Jerusalem under siege? I think you'll agree that Sennacherib's officers deploy all the classic tactics of the propaganda expert in what they say to Hezekiah and to the others on this occasion. First, you notice how they try to discredit the leader, portraying Hezekiah as a dangerous fanatic, leading his people to certain disaster. Verse 11, when Hezekiah says the Lord our God will save us from the hand of the king of Assyria, he's misleading you to let you die of hunger and thirst. And then, in having discredited the leader, they try to undermine popular morale. Verse 13, don't you know what I and my fathers have done to all the peoples of the other lands? Were the gods of those nations able to deliver their land from my hand? Who of all the gods of these nations that my fathers destroyed has been able to save his people from me? How then can your God deliver you from my hand? In other words, he's saying, Look at our record. We Assyrians have a 100% record when it comes to sieges. What makes you think you're going to be any different? And thirdly, you notice how the propaganda keeps up the pressure. Verse 17. He also wrote letters insulting the Lord, the God of Israel, and saying this against him. Just as the gods of the people of the other lands did not rescue their people from my hand, so the God of Hezekiah will not rescue his people from my hand. And then they called out in Hebrew to the people of Jerusalem who were on the wall to terrify them and make them afraid. Notice, though, at every step, the principal target of Sennacherib's propaganda assault. It's their faith in God he's attacking, isn't it? Every time. When did faith in God ever stop an arrow or lift a siege, he says. You can't seriously be suggesting that your God is special. That's what all the others thought till we destroyed them. The chronicler surely wants us to realize here that in just such a way does the unbelieving world always try to undermine the confidence, the spiritual confidence of God's people. The logic of faith eludes them. Because they have shown some religions to be empty superstitions, they assume that the same is true of all religion. Indeed, if you look at verse 12 of chapter 32, you'll see that it's clear Sennacherib just didn't understand the difference between one religion and another. In his pluralistic mindset, he interprets the results of Hezekiah's reform on the pagan superstition and shrines as evidence of Hezekiah's irreligion. Verse 12, did not Hezekiah himself remove this God's high places and altars, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship before one altar and burn sacrifices on it? He got his garbled version of Hezekiah's reform. And because he was a polytheist himself, he couldn't make sense of what was going on. As the chronicler puts it in verse 19, they spoke about the God of Jerusalem as they did about the gods of the other peoples of the world, the works of men's hands. They couldn't see a difference. But of course there is a difference. Hezekiah knew that. And Sennacherib, as the penalty of his Promethean arrogance, would find it out to his cost. Look at verse 20. King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, son of Amos, cried out in prayer. So much we've learned about prayer today. Here's another reference, this conference rather. Here's another reference to it. Cried out in prayer to heaven about this. And the Lord sent an angel who annihilated all the fighting men and the leaders and officers in the camp of the Assyrian king. So he withdrew to his own land in disgrace. And when he went into the temple of his God, some of his sons cut him down with the sword. No hiding, is there, the irony of that line. This man who boasted that all gods were equally powerless, in the end proved that that was certainly true of his own gods. But it was not true of the God of Israel. Verse 22, so the Lord saved Hezekiah and the people of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, king of Assyria. This then is how Judah survived her crisis, this crisis of faith. She refused to surrender. And even 100 years later, you know, it wasn't a lack of confidence in God which we notice in Jerusalem. If anything, it is a rather superstitious and ill-founded complacency about the inviolability of Jerusalem. Because they had learnt their lesson, at least in part, maybe not well enough. Well, it's not difficult to understand why this story was of such value to the chronicler, is it? As we said yesterday, the chronicler wrote his history 300 years after Hezekiah's death as a kind of sermon of encouragement for his own contemporaries. He lived among that tiny community of Jews who had returned from exile in Babylon to try to rebuild the nation of Israel. I suspect they must have felt they were facing a crisis of faith too. Surrounded as they were by mighty, self-confident, imperialistic powers like Persia and Greece. What possible relevance could the God of the Bible have in a world dominated by huge political and cultural giants who are completely ignorant of his existence? And how could they be so arrogant? Surely it was lunatic to suggest that a tiny, insignificant Middle Eastern principality was the sole guardian of true religion. That their God, of all the gods of the ancient world, was alone real and powerful and worthy of praise. It might have been possible to believe that kind of thing in the golden age of David and Solomon. But not now, not after conquest and exile. The crisis that faced the chronicler's contemporaries was the same that faced Hezekiah's Judah. How can you go on believing in the sovereign God of the Bible when the world seems to be dominated by mighty forces of evil? And when the tiny handful who continue to profess trust in him feel humiliated, despised, powerless? Well, Hezekiah proved you can go on believing in such circumstances. In spite of all appearances, there is, he says, a greater power with us than with the king of Assyria. With him is only the arm of flesh. With us is the Lord our God. And I suggest you, if that was the assurance that the chronicler's contemporaries needed to rediscover, it is surely the assurance the Church of Jesus needs to rediscover in the days we live in. Undoubtedly, as I said at the beginning, there is a similarity between Judah's political predicament at the end of the 8th century BC and the political predicament of Britain 50 years ago. But as Basil was suggesting last night, there is an even greater correspondence between the spiritual predicament of Judah at the 8th century of BC and the spiritual predicament of Britain, not in 1939, but today, at the end of the 20th century. We too face a crisis today. Not a military crisis any longer, it's true. But a crisis nevertheless, a crisis of faith. I don't think anybody has expressed this contemporary crisis of faith more powerfully than Matthew Arnold, the poet, in a very great poem entitled Dover Beach. Some of you may know it. Arnold composed that poem on the beach at Dover, watching the tide about to turn. He sensed in its retreat from the shore a picture of the ebbing away of the Christian convictions of modern man. The sea of faith was once too at the full, he wrote, and round earth's shore, but now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar. Arnold wrote in the middle of the 19th century. In those days, Britain brimmed with humanistic confidence in the future. Religious skepticism, we were being told, was nothing to worry about. The same science which was eroding belief in God would enable man to become a god himself. Without supernatural aid, the evolutionary progress of the human race would create its own utopian destiny. The religious worldviews of earlier ages had been rendered redundant, they said. At last, man had come of age. He could manage the world for himself without the support of any paternalistic deity to prop him up or to lean upon. As Arnold's younger contemporary Nietzsche put it, God is dead. All that remains, he said, is to exorcise his phantom shadow from the caves of human superstition in which he continues to lurk. It was widely believed by intellectuals at the end of the 19th century that the religion of the Bible had become a cultural anachronism in a scientific age. The tide of faith had indeed turned, and it was deemed only a matter of time before Christianity passed into the oblivion which Greek mythology and medieval witchcraft had passed before it. But where others in his day hailed this ebbing away of the sea of faith with glee and confidence, Matthew Arnold, interestingly, in that poem, Dover Beach, glimpses the barrenness of the naked shingle that would be exposed. And he places a solemn question mark against the scientific and secular optimism of his day. The world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, he says, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. And can't help feel there was a prophetic insight in that reference to ignorant armies clashing. For nothing did more to prove Arnold's suspicions about the failure of humanism than the devastating spectacle of the two great wars which tore Europe apart, since he wrote. And now I suggest to you, in 1989, at the end of the 20th century, Europe has indeed become the bleak spiritual desert Arnold foresaw. A people disillusioned with the religion of their forefathers, but with no alternative to put in its place. So what is happening? We wander in a fog of pluralistic confusion, willing to try anything but to trust nothing. If there really is a God, as the Christians say there is, what about evolution? What about other religions? What about biblical criticism? What about Auschwitz? What about Hiroshima? What about Cambodia? What about famines in Ethiopia and earthquakes in Latin America and floods in Bangladesh? What about Lockerbie and Clapham? We can't believe in God any longer, people tell us. But neither can we believe the optimistic mouthings of those 19th century secular humanists. Christianity seems dwarfed by titanic religious and philosophical rivals. And yet nothing commands the faith of our people in its place. The sea of faith has ebbed, all right, and left in its wake, just as it did in the days of Hezekiah, you see, a credibility gap, a spiritual vacuum. And you know as well as I do that into that vacuum today is pouring every kind of pagan and occult nonsense. As Chesterton said, when people give up believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. That's what's happening today. A witchcraft school in Milton Keynes. A New Age cult sweeps the United States. So it goes on and on and on. Now, how is the man or woman of God to respond in such a situation, such a spiritual emergency? How are we to face the crisis of faith in which Europe is plunged at the end of the 20th century? Well, I suggest to you Hezekiah is the model for the chronicler, and he provides a model for us too. What did he do? Let me remind you. First, he reformed the church. Remember what he said? In verse 11, "My sons, do not be negligent now, for the Lord has chosen you to stand before him and serve him." One of the greatest barriers to faith in any age is the apostasy of Christian clergy. The sea of faith will never return while we tolerate in the church ministers who are content simply to swim with the receding tide of doubt. Bishops who parade how little they believe of the creed. Theologians who assure us that Hinduism and Islam are alternative routes to salvation. Clergymen who affirm their homosexual relationships with pride. Such things have to go. Our 20th century crisis of faith can never be survived unless, like Hezekiah, we purify the church of such things. Now, it is very easy for us in a group like this to pat ourselves on the back, like virgins in a brothel, to pretend to ourselves that we have nothing to do with all this apostasy and heresy and immorality in the church. That, I suggest to you, is not how God sees it. I don't think God even notices these denominational labels that matter so much to us. When he looks at this country, he doesn't see the Church of England. He sees the Church in England. And we belong to it. Let's face it, even historically, we nonconformists were excluded from the Church of England by the Act of Uniformity back in the 17th century. Historically, you could claim we have as great a title to be a voice for Christendom in this country as anybody else. We don't have to withdraw then into some embarrassed clique or say that's all the business of the Archbishop of Canterbury, it's nothing to do with us. If the Archbishop of Canterbury will not speak out in the cause of reformation in the church, then we must. Historically, nonconformists always have. And it may very well be that a reformation in this country will begin in nonconformity and not in the Church of England at all. But I assure you, revival in this country cannot come without involving the Church of England. I do not believe revival in this country can come without involving the Church of England. We must be desperately concerned for our brothers and sisters who are evangelicals within that fold. And we cannot shrink back into some private little concern, as if Hezekiah should sit in Judah and say of his brothers and sisters in northern Israel, well, hard luck on them, that's all their fault for past mistakes. We must be desperately concerned, as he was, to see the reunification of the people of God in the cause of biblical reformation. That must be our desire if we truly want to survive the crisis of faith at the end of the 20th century. And we mustn't underestimate how quickly it could happen. Do you remember how the Chronicle points out the speed of the Reformation in Jerusalem? All it took was a single sermon from Hezekiah. In Luther's day, all it took was 99 theses nailed to a church door. Never underestimate how quickly the church scene can change once a fire of reformation begins to burn. That was the first thing he did then. He reformed the church. Secondly, he re-evangelized the nation. Remember verse 6 of chapter 30? At the king's command, couriers went throughout Israel and Judah. People of Israel, return to the Lord that he may return to you. Now, I talk an awful lot to non-Christian students especially, but people of all sorts. And my experience is the vast majority of people in this country are not atheists. They are confused. They are spiritually rootless. The Assyria of secular humanism has besieged them. And Christian faith has lost its plausibility in their minds. But they are very far from being closed to the gospel. Revival may be much closer than we dare to imagine. It may be that all that is required is for evangelicals to rediscover their confidence and take the message to the country as Hezekiah did. But if such a program of re-evangelization is to be undertaken, it will not do merely to go for the soft targets, the middle-class Bible Belt of Guildford and Sevenoaks and Cheam. What an indictment of us it was when last night at our late-night special, we stood up to show where we came from, and a good three-quarters of us come from the southeast. That's an indictment. We haven't re-evangelized the nation yet, then, have we? No, we must reach out to those places where perhaps we fear a hostile reception. Areas of our culture which, for Many years, many generations perhaps, have felt ostracized from the church by misunderstanding and prejudice. Inner city tenements and working class pubs and council estates and immigrant ghettos. Like Hezekiah, our couriers and evangelists must recognize no no-go areas. They must be ready to be scorned and ridiculed by some. But isn't it true to say there never was a revival yet which did not find its most fertile soil among those previously alienated from the Church of Jesus Christ by social and cultural barriers? And our invitation is even more universal in its scope than Hezekiah's, isn't it? His embraced all the tribes of Israel. Our appeal embraces all the nations of the globe. Christ, our Passover, has been slain for us. So let's come and celebrate the feast. That's our message. The Lord God still lives. The saving God still saves. We must refuse then to give up on our nation. Verse 9 again. If you return to the Lord, he will not turn his face from you. He reformed the church. He re-evangelized the nation. And the third thing he did, he refused to surrender to the enemy. Be strong and courageous. Don't be afraid or discouraged because of the king of Assyria and the vast army with him, for there is a greater power with us than with him. You see, they were feeling intimidated. Don't we? Intimidated by cultural forces which seem so much stronger and more vigorous than we are. They will try to make out the Christian faith is no different from any other. In their secular pluralist mindset, they will tell us we are blind fanatics to hold that Jesus is any greater than a dozen other great religious leaders. They will call us fools for going to churches where outdated and obscurantist Hezekiahs fill us with crazy notions about the promises of God and the power of prayer. They will scorn the irrelevance of our biblical preaching. They will scorn the ineffectualness of our repentant tears. They will scorn the naivety of our simple, old-fashioned faith. But at the end of the day, it will be their gods that prove impotent, not ours. The empty tomb is on our side. God has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man he has appointed. And he has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. Do you know the Greek word for judgment? It's crisis. A crisis is a judgment. The way we respond to this contemporary crisis of faith will, I suggest to you, be our judge. We may yield to the skeptical pressure of the world. There have been churches, you know, which have been obliterated from the face of the earth. Think of North Africa. Think of Asia Minor. It is not true to say that the church is immune from dissolution. Not at least in those local sorts of areas. We might yield to the skeptical pressure of the world. The church in this country, the church in Europe, could become as dead, as poverty-stricken, as the church in Islamic countries today. The center of gravity of Christendom could shift to Africa and East Asia and Latin America. Maybe that's what God purposes. But I do pray not. I do pray not. We must not give up the battle before it is lost. We are in the days of Hezekiah. There is a crisis of faith, but the issue hangs in the balance. We may also refuse to surrender and beseech God, as Hezekiah and Isaiah did, for a mighty deliverance from this crisis into which the people of God have come. I don't know about you, but I'm with Hezekiah. Who is he that overcomes the world? He who believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Little children, you will overcome them, because greater is he who is in you than the one who is in the world. Let's pray together.